Hello and welcome to another episode of Another Brick in the Wall. I think this is probably one of the most exciting episodes we're ever going to record. This season two has been focusing on building in remote locations, and I think nothing can be more remote, at least in our imagination, probably in our experience, than building in Antarctica. And today I have the pleasure to be talking to Falcon Scott, who's a great-grandson of Captain Robert Falcon Scott, who built Scott's Hut back in 1910 in what's now become known as Scott's Point. So, hi Falcon.
Hello, nice and thanks for joining. Yeah, I mean, I'm actually grandson, but yeah, and the hut is at a place called Cape Adare on Ross Island in Antarctica. So this is the Ross Sea part of Antarctica, the bit below New Zealand.
Yeah, and for those that can't sort of picture this and imagine it, how long does it get to take there from a place like London?
Yes. Well, they went in ships, of course. No, it was before air travel, really. So, I mean, basically about 6 to 9 months. I think they left in about May or June, and they didn't get there till basically the early part of 1911. So, just over 6 months.
Okay. And today, I understand there's been a huge initiative that's been going on since it became part of the Heritage Trust to restore and to preserve and maintain the hut. So if there's an expedition leaving at the moment to work on the hut, how long does it take to get there?
Well, these days they fly in with the Americans to McMurdo, and then they, helicopter them out to the actual hut, which is only about 20 miles away from the McMurdo airfield. So, yeah, not very long. I mean, a few hours, five-hour flight to McMurdo from Christchurch, and then, a 10-minute flight.
Whatever time it takes.
Yeah, a 10-minute flight to the actual site. But, yeah, not very long, within 24 hours anyway.
Well, it's... I understand you're a builder, and you know what it's like to sometimes work on a site when, your supply shops and material shops are 20 minutes away now, half the way across the world. I guess a lot of things have to be prepared well in advance before getting there.
Absolutely. I mean, I was working for the New Zealand Antarctic Heritage Trust, and they had spent months organising this job. Stuff had been flown out. In fact, some of the stuff had been flown out a year before. And also they already had huts out there, which had been taken out there across the sea ice. Probably originally come in either by ship or flown in from Christchurch. But yeah, they had huts, they had solar panels, they had a whole lot of materials that they may or may not need, and all the logistics associated with all of that.
Yeah. Okay. Before we go into sort of what's being done at the hut at the moment, I kind of just want to go back in time 115 years and think back at when the hut was first built. So I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the hut was originally prefabricated in Sydney, and then it was shipped out to the Antarctic as part of the expedition. Do you know anything about how they planned it, designed it back in the days? Because Sydney is not necessarily Antarctica, is it?
I'm not actually sure of the detail of that, but they would have had a good idea of what they would require. Don't forget that they had already had the Discovery Expedition, which they'd also brought a hut from Australia, which in fact they didn't really live in, because on the Discovery Expedition, they lived in the ship, which was also a wooden ship, but it was a new ship as well. But the ship was very comfortable, so they lived in the ship, and the ship stayed actually wintered in the Antarctic, so they were able to stay in the ship. So for the Terra Nova expedition, it was always planned that the ship would go back to New Zealand. So that meant they needed a hut they could live in. So this is a completely different idea, really, having a hut that you can definitely live in. So yeah, double skin, insulation, carefully thought out design so that they all had their workstation. It was a scientific expedition, primarily, really, of which the South Pole, of course, was just one of many goals. But they had to design it around the science that they wanted to do. And of course, all that was designed around their experience was in the previous discovery expedition, which was in 1901 to 1904.
Okay, so this we're talking about the 1910 expedition.
Yeah, the Terra Nova expedition.
The Terra Nova. And a lot of learnings came out from how the first expedition had gone. And presumably, the architects or the builders who put this hut together fed off that and developed it.
Yes, I think there would have been a huge lot of input from London, and you know they would have definitely passed the plans, etc., and given them all the criteria necessary to have a design that was going to work for them. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the design really did work for them very well. I mean, there's been some criticism about separating the officers and the scientists from the other man. But don't forget that most of the people on this expedition were naval people. You know, they were used to life in the British Navy in those days, which are obviously very different to nowadays. You know, we have to accept the standards of those days were not the same as the standards that we enjoy today.
No, I think culturally we're talking about almost two separate worlds, really.
Yeah, exactly. But nevertheless, they were, I think generally that all the men were pretty happy in that hut.
How many people were staying in the hut at this point?
26.
26 people, wow.
26 people wintered.
That's quite amazing.
And in the Terra Nova hut. So that's actually quite a lot of people.
Yeah, it is.
of which at least 12 were scientists.
And I understand that the heating and sort of comfort was achieved partly by insulation, but also by some form of blubber stove that was sitting in the middle.
Yeah, they had a stove that was in the center of the hut. And yeah, I mean, they used to burn blubber amongst other things, but they also burnt coal on it. They had coal supplies as well.
Okay. It's interesting. I don't know. When we were doing the research for this, I was wondering, well, how am I going to be able to talk a little bit about a building I've never seen and in most likelihood will never have an opportunity to go and see probably. But there's a very good website from the Heritage Trust that shows quite a lot of details about it, about the conservation initiatives. But also I understand Google or somebody has sent 360 cameras around and you can actually just go on Google Maps and find it and have a look inside.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. They've made kind of, I think, several virtual tours.
Yeah.
Of the hut these days. And yeah, it goes into quite a lot of the detail. I mean, they have done, the Antarctic Heritage Trust has done an amazing job on those huts. I mean, they've also done Shackleton's hut and also Ed Hillary's hut from the 1950s. So yeah, and then they've actually preserved a lot of the artifacts because there were things like tinned food that were still there, even things like cake and butter and stuff that, you know, they've actually managed to preserve it. I think there's more than 10,000 artifacts they've managed to, you know, restore in some way, in some form or other.
Restore.
So, yeah.
And these presumably can be visited and seen somewhere in the vicinity, or they've been moved to museums all over the world?
Most of it's still in the hut. I mean, they've returned. Most of the artifacts are actually have been returned to the hut. And yeah, you can go and visit it, but you have to either get a job with the science people in nearby McMurdo or Scott Base, or go as a tourist, which is obviously very expensive on a cruise ship.
So the hut, from what I see in the plans and what I've been able to see, is basically almost like a perfect square. There's got some kind of an overhang on three sides to presumably either keep. Is it a second skin? It's a first skin? How does it?
Yeah, the hut's a basic rectangle. And then they've got on one side, they've got like a porch extension, like a lean-to porch. And then on the northern side, which is the shelter side, they had a stables lean to for the ponies as well. And actually, the latrines, which were also on the north side, are actually separated from the hut. They're in a kind of hut of their own.
Yeah, because they don't figure on the sort of plan I'm looking at the moment.
No, they don't.
So there's the veranda that runs around. There's this large space, which they call the main space, that has the stove in it. And then there's the exhibition area, not exhibition, but the physical labs and science area to the left as I'm looking.
And the only person that had his own separate enclosure was actually Ponting, the photographer. He had his own enclosure within the hut, obviously dark room. And the scientists actually had their bunks where they worked. So their bunks were effectively in the lab. And they were pretty close to each other. I mean, it was pretty tight squeeze living in those conditions. And they were all, the scientists were in one end of the hut. And then the other men were in the other end, effectively in the galley. And they had bunks in there as well.
Do you know how long it took to put up the hut when they first got down to the expedition?
It took about 48 hours to get all the supplies ashore from the ship. And then they built the hut within the week.
Okay. And this is a timber framed structure.
Yeah. And that was in January, which is high summer in Ross Island. And high summer it doesn't really get that cold generally. It's not much below, say, -5.
Okay, so that's a comfortable Antarctic temperature.
And it can be t-shirt hot. If the sun's out, temperature can be only maybe 5 degrees, but the sun can be very bright and it can be hot in the sun. So, yeah, I mean, there are photographs of them working in t-shirts, basically, setting up the camp. So, yeah, they wouldn't have been that uncomfortable before they had the hut.
Did they take any specialist builders with them to put up the hut, or was it put up by the expeditioners themselves, the scientists, the people from the Navy?
Yeah, they had carpenters. There will have been amongst the crew members, there will have been carpenters. I mean, in those days, carpenters went on all ships anyway, several carpenters. So, yeah, they will have had, not actually sure who actually put up the hut, but I mean, it was prefabricated. It was fairly straightforward. The most complicated thing would have been getting it off the ship and putting all the pieces together. You know, it's a bit like a three-dimensional jigsaw. But once it got organized, and Bowers, Henry Bowers, was the man who organized all that. So Bowers knew where everything was when it was, he actually loaded the ship, or was in charge of loading the ship with Terra Nova. And it's unbelievable how much stuff they got on that ship, because it wasn't a very big ship.
No, it's fascinating. And The building was then, unfortunately, as we know, the expedition didn't have a very good ending. And the building was left there, presumably. Was it returned to recently after, or how?
Well, I mean, first of all, I don't think the expedition wasn't successful.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Very successful.
Well, I think it was very successful. Yes, they lost people, including the leader on the South Pole endeavor. But they did get to the South Pole, and they got nearly all the way back. They had a lot of bad luck and bad weather. And that left all the scientists that weren't on that foray to the South Pole at the hut. And a lot of scientific work was done. We're looking at a period of 2 years here, from when they landed to when they left. 2 full years. It's a long time. And in that time, you know, they did a lot of science, and they did a lot of other expeditions out 400 miles in different directions over the ice shelf and up onto the ice cap in the mountain, you know, above the mountains. So, yeah, I mean, it was, and scientifically, it was probably the most successful Antarctic expedition of that era. So, but yeah, so they left in 1913, And then nothing much happened initially until Shackleton's men went there in 1914, 15, 16. And they went to set up the other expedition from the one that went to the Weddell Sea to cross Antarctica.
And they used this as a base.
Yes, they did. The it was called the Ross Sea Party. And the idea was that they were to lay depots over the ice shelf to service Shackleton's team as they came, you know, through from the pole, having crossed the continent, which of course never happened. But they did set up the depots, and actually three men died on that expedition as well, setting up the depots. And they had a huge problem with the ship getting blown out. They, unlike the Terra Nova, when they managed to get all the supplies ashore in time because they rushed it, the Aurora, which is the ship, got blown out with the ice and never came back. Basically, left with having to set up all these depots without having had the supplies brought ashore. So they, you know, they killed a lot of seals and penguins, basically, and took the meat inland and used that for the depots.
And presumably used the blubber as well for heating.
Yeah. They used the hut and until they were rescued in 1916 by Shackleton himself on the Aurora from New Zealand.
I think it's hard for most people listening and even for myself to understand some of the conditions these men lived through. We think about travel these days and it's relatively easy. You book a flight, you go halfway around the world relatively cheaply, let's say, and you can just pick up a home and Airbnb something and that's it. You look around and you come back. Now, these are monumental expeditions that take months in planning, months to set up, and then all of a sudden your ship blows away or ship you're waiting for doesn't turn up to resupply you and life becomes quite wild.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I mean, they survived winters as well in this hut.
Mm-hmm. And winter can go down to what in this part of the Antarctic?
Oh, temperatures go down to maybe minus 40 on the coast here. I mean, it's not as cold as it further inland.
Still pretty extreme.
But it's a very dry atmosphere. It's extremely dry. It's pretty much one of the driest places on the planet. So it can snow, but then all the snow evaporates.
Yeah.
It's quite weird. It doesn't melt, it evaporates.
That's strange.
And there's not much snow there for that reason, because it just evaporates.
Yeah, but there's a lot of ice.
Yeah, but it evaporates from even from the ice. The ice that doesn't melt, it evaporates. It's really weird. So there's a lot of weird shaped ice that you can't really explain how it's got to like that, but that's because of the evaporation.
And yourself, obviously, you had an interest in this hut and in the expeditions because of family connections, I understand, but how was it to first get involved with it and actually go down and be part of the restoration effort?
It was really amazing. I mean, I applied. I was actually ended up being a bit of a junior because they'd already been working. When I got down there, they'd already been working on it for 4 years. So I was kind of late on the scene. For me, it was a totally amazing experience.
When did you go down?
2011, 12. The summer of 2011.
The initiative had been going on since...
2007, it started on the restoration, yeah.
Okay. And between that Shackleton expedition and 2007, do we know if it was occupied a few more times or what had happened to it?
It was pretty much abandoned until the 1950s when the Americans set up McMurdo. And when that happened... Basically, the huts were pretty much trashed by the people that were down there. a lot of stuff was taken out of the huts as well. And yeah, a bit sad, really. Not much respect in those days, post-war, you know. So, and then about the 1970s, they started to realize, especially the New Zealanders started to realize, hang on a minute, you know, you can't just go around trashing the huts. But they need to be restored. So some restoration work started in the late 70s and 1980s. And then they kind of did a little bit of superficial restoration. I think the new roof was put on it. And then in the early part of this century, in the 2000s, they really thought, right, no, this has to be done properly. They started to raise a lot of money. They set up the whole kind of New Zealand Antarctic Heritage Trust a bit better. And then they got on to doing the restoration itself. And I'd say about 2007, they started, 2007, 2008, they started with actually sending a team down there. With the help of the Americans as well. I mean, the people at McMurdo have been very helpful with the logistics. So, yeah, and since then, people have given a lot of money and it's been totally restored. And it has cost a lot.
Is there an annual expedition at the moment to continue work on it?
Yeah, every summer they send down a team to do, you know, different stuff. I mean, recent years a lot of the ice has been, you know, there's been less ice around the hut.
Yeah, I've seen.
So they've actually found quite a lot of more artifacts in the sort of along the beach and digging in, you know, in the scoria.
And you're a builder by trade, as we've discussed earlier. When you went down there, what was your role? And also, if you don't mind sort of telling us a bit, how were you guys housed whilst you were doing the restoration?
Well, I got a job. I got paid. It was a proper job. I got a proper interview and everything. And I was employed as a conservation carpenter.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I went down. I had to have some training, which I got at Scott Base, some field training. Then I had to, before I went down, I had to read a lot of documents about the process of how they did the restoration, what we could and couldn't do, and how we were to go about the work, et cetera, et cetera. So, yeah, I mean, I went down there. I think because I was a junior, I was given the job of restoring the latrines. So I think they thought that was appropriate because I don't know, maybe they thought I'd be overly posh or something, but I think they thought I needed a job that brought me down to earth a bit. Anyway, it was fine. And in fact, in the end, I had one of the best jobs, I think, on the site because I was on the north side, which was the sunny side, and I actually got an Antarctic tan while I was working on those latrines. So, but yeah, it was good. I enjoyed it. It was very, I mean, it was very slow because work that at home I would do in a few hours actually took days because of the whole protocols of how we had to go about, you know, to take before photographs, after photographs.
Okay.
We had to, everything had to be put back exactly in the right place and the right orientation, etc., etc. So it was very slow, but it's good. And we lived in tents. We actually lived in Scott tents.
Okay.
Which were the old-fashioned canvas tents.
Yeah.
And they were fine. I mean, we got basically a tent each. And inside probably about 2.5 meters diameter, 8 feet diameter. So, yeah, it's quite a lot of space. You could, you know, in the middle of the tent, you could stand up. You could hang your socks up to dry. They got a bit sweaty, etc. They got a really warm sleeping bag that, you know, you could get fully undressed to sleep. You didn't have to, you know, it was like kind of glamping almost. It was quite easy going. I mean, I did at one point, I spilled a glass of water on the floor of the tent. I thought, oh, God, that's awful. And, you know, all the stuff's going to get wet. I thought my sleeping bag's going to get wet. And I went away to go and get a cloth from the from the mess hut. And when I came back, it had evaporated. An entire glass of water had evaporated in the space of about 10 minutes.
No, that's how dry the climate.
That shows how dry it was. And we had to use, you know, creams, you know, moisturizers. Any exposed skin, we had to moisturize ourselves. Otherwise, you looked about 80 within, you know, within a day, made you go all wrinkly. I mean, most of the time I was there was January, so it was high summer and it was sunny. A lot of the time it was sunny. And we had a few storms, and I did work at one point in minus 11, which was quite cold. Struggle. We had hand warmers, we had good equipment. And a lot of the work, if you weren't outside doing it, you could actually do it in the workshop. They had a workshop hut, which had a few power tools in it. So some of the stuff could be done in the workshop as well, which was kind of heated by, well, solar energy, really. The mess hut actually had a boiler and a cooker, which was oil-fired. So the mess hut was actually also warm. So if we did get cold, we could go into the mess hut to thaw out. A team of eight people, yeah.
And how many people were there with you for the restaurant? Presumably men and women now? It was still mostly men, like back in 1910.
There was one woman and seven guys.
People from all sorts of life, or mostly people with also some construction background?
Yeah, there were three Canadians, there were other New Zealand people, there was another guy from Scotland, an Australian guy, the girl, she was from New Zealand. Yeah, no, it was a good team. We used to go on walks at night. It was light all, you know, 24-hour light. It was actually sunny 24 hours in the January.
All day long. Quite different from a January back in Scotland, I'd say.
Yeah. And we used to sunbathe, you know, after dinner at night, at 10 o'clock at night, you could actually sunbathe.
So we're all here back in Europe worrying about you and people doing this kind of work, and it's...
They actually had a sun deck on the end of the container where the mess hut was, and we could sit out on the sun deck, and it was warm enough to sit out. Kind of, with not too many clothes on. You maybe did have a couple of layers on, but it was warm enough to sit out in the sun at 10 o'clock at night.
And basically, the hut has been restored. Now it's somewhere people can go and visit. Is there any science still being done?
They have about 2,500 visitors a year in that hut. So, I mean, most of those people are people that go on excursions from McMurdo. But they also have, I think, maybe half a dozen cruise ships during the season. So the season is basically late January, February, because they can't get in for the ice before that. The ice goes out about second, third week in January.
Okay. And presumably there are now other buildings in the region, not at the point itself, but around Ross Island.
Well, there's the McMurdo base, which is huge. I think when I was there, about 1,300 people living there.
Okay. Did you visit some of it?
Yeah. I spent quite a lot of time at Scott Base, quite a few days anyway, at Scott Base, which is a New Zealand base, and that's 2 miles away from McMurdo. And there's a road that runs in between Scott Base and McMurdo. Biggest road in all of Antarctica. Yeah, and I mean, I got to walk around McMurdo a couple of times. Yeah, interesting. Yeah, interesting place.
How are these? Let's call them modern buildings. How much do they differ? Because the original huts are timber based.
Yeah, there's a lot of steel used these days because it's quick to fabricate. And, you know, it's quite a good material, I guess, to use.
How does it weather? Just on appearance, obviously, you can't judge from that.
The architecture in McMurdo is awful. I told them they need to address the architecture because I'm quite keen on good architecture as well. And McMurdo is a real mess. They told me that they do think about it and that they will try and, you know, think about that, improve it. But, it's just a lot of tin huts, basically. made of, you know, pressed steel, etc.
And they're resupplied monthly?
They get one huge ship in every year, which has everything. And if it doesn't go on the ship, then it has to be flown out from Christchurch on these big military C-17 planes, which can carry, you know, big stuff. I mean, they're designed for carrying, you know, big tanks and stuff, so they can carry heavy loads. But obviously expensive. I mean, when I was there, they told me each flight cost $250,000, each flight, and they did two flights a week.
Do you think you'll ever go back and have a look at it again?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I might do. I was going to be on a trip on a cruise ship in February, but they've changed the itinerary now. We're just doing the peninsula instead. But yeah, I mean, if I get offered another trip there, I probably would go on it. Yeah, I did go on a ship years ago in 1995 when I was younger. I went on a ship with my mother, and I got to McMurdo. I didn't actually see the hut itself because the weather was too rough, but I got to McMurdo and I climbed Observation Hill, which is where the memorial is. So, yeah. And the memorial to the five people on top of Observation Hill, it's a cross, which is basically the only sort of proper memorial to the five people that died on the South Pole expedition. So yeah, that's quite emotional for me as well.
I can understand that. And do you think that, and sorry if it's a very personal question, but do you think the legacy of your grandfather kind of led you to also want to explore and discover more about the world?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I haven't traveled massively around the world, but I've been to the Antarctic quite a few times.
I know a lot of people can say that.
And when I was down there, I did do quite a lot of exploring. I did a lot of walking when I was working at the hut, both actually at the site and also at McMurdo and around Scott Base. So, and I do now work on some of these cruise ships, and I do like to do walks when I'm on the ship. I do like to do the hikes and do a bit of exploring. And I've done a lot of exploring around Europe. In the UK, Scotland, etc. I mean, Scotland's great for exploring. There's so much in the Highlands to explore. So, yeah.
A lot of exploring, I think, has to do with not so much as how far we go, but what kind of attitude we go to these places and how we're looking at them. I think it's fascinating. I wish one day I'll have the opportunity to go down to the Antarctic. It's on my plans. I don't know if it'll happen. But it's something that I would definitely like to do.
Well, for me, it's about exploring oneself, I think, largely. I mean, a lot of these places people have been to before. Thinking about, you know, exploring in the Highlands, and you know, lots of people have climbed all the mountains, etc. But you know, when you go and do it yourself, it is an exploration for yourself. It is because you're testing your own physique in many ways. You're testing your own, you know, ability and you in the logistics of planning it and actually doing it and minding out the weather and all, you know, all of those things and not falling off rocks or killing yourself. So, you know, all these things, it's testing yourself. And, you know, in addition to that, you're discovering, you know, amazing, beautiful places and seeing great scenery and just looking at in wonder at all the natural aspects of what you're discovering. So that, for me, that's what it's about. And yeah, I mean, you know, occasionally people do discover new stuff, but there's not so much of that these days. But I don't think it's much different to how they were, you know. Yeah, they discovered new mountains and stuff and new places, and they mapped it and everything. But we don't have to do that now. We can just enjoy it probably a lot more.
I think that's a great sort of observation and a great point to finish this interview. Once again, thank you, Falcon Scott, for taking the time to be on this podcast with us. It's been a pleasure to hear about your experience and your family's experience in the Antarctic. It's an amazing building that I think will inspire people for a long, long time.
Okay, well, it's a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
And I hope people will have the opportunity to visit. If not, they can see it online at the Heritage Trust site or on Google Maps, just to have an idea of what it was like to set up camp in the Antarctic nearly 115 years ago. Well, thank you very much. For those back at home, bye for now.